Andy Kamenetsky. We've got a fantastic guest, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the NBA's all-time leading scorer, 5 rings with the Showtime Lakers, another with the Milwaukee Bucks, and hello to the Bucks fans listening right now as well. He's also a very prolific writer, author, historian, documentarian, and he's the co-executive producer of a new project debuting tonight, February 19th, on history, Black Patriots, Heroes of the Revolutionary, a documentary honoring Black heroes who fought on the front lines of the Revolutionary War for U.S. independence. Again, premiering February 19th, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Kareem, thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it.
No problem. Nice to talk to you.
You're somebody who's really devoted your life to learning and sharing history. You are, I believe, a history major at UCLA, but this is a part of American history that admittedly you didn't know much about growing up. Before even getting into the stuff that we learn, how often do you just encounter inaccuracies or incomplete history when it comes to Black history in particular and what's being taught in this country's school books?
Well, I think too many of our history books in America do not have the right focus. I think the perspective of the people who write the history books is in question. Most of the history books that we deal with have the perspective of trying to see how what happened in America affected people from Europe. So if you're a person of color, you're not from Europe, but your history is marginalized or eliminated. And I think that's what the problem is. Most of the history books that I dealt with when I was in grade school and high school did not ever mention Black people except with exception to the two issues of slavery and civil rights. And we had no idea of Black people doing anything else in our country. And I think that's a shame.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, it's interesting the way you've used the phrase deal with in terms of those school books. And I've seen you use that phrase in some other interviews talking about the documentary. And I think it's interesting phrasing in the sense that you're literally forced to deal with the inaccuracies and incompleteness in those books, but also that this is part of a history that just isn't being dealt with in this country in terms of just facing it.
Yeah, and that reflects a mindset of the people who write history books that people of color are irrelevant. And, you know, that's very unfortunate.
Yeah, the documentary to me really, it underscores that disconnect between America and, you know, the mission statement that supposedly was there at its formation, because you get a sense of how from the outset the colonists saw themselves as slaves to England and their laws and inequities that they thought were inherent to the system, but they're simultaneously okay with literal enslavement, you know, of black Americans, black citizens, if you want to call it that, in America, just that disconnect that they're not seeing.
The whole idea of enslaving people because it's going to enrich you and make you wealthy is okay with Americans, but being subject to the whims of George III, Americans didn't like that. And kind of hard to get your head around it, because in America, we've taken that for granted for so long. It seems rational, but it's not rational.
No, and it's just interesting how much of that history in America continues on today, where there's certain things that we're not either willing to look at or willing to really confront, talk about in terms of how this history has been shaped. And then ultimately, I think what we can really do about it, because the roots of a lot of these problems that we have literally go back to the Revolutionary War and the formation of America and what supposedly America was about at its outset.
Exactly. That we try to carry that forward. It becomes very difficult. When our nation started, women weren't allowed to vote. Native Americans did not participate in our democracy, nor did blacks and other people of color. And this has had a profound effect on our whole history, our legal system, our justice system. And it's something that we have to look at when we talk about these things.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, too. The movie opens with you quoting Jackie Robinson, where you say a life is not important except for the impact that it has on others. That was something that Jackie Robinson had said. And it felt to me like it's this reminder, too, of how all of history is connected, because different lives have impact on other lives, and then it continues generationally. And it reminds me, too, of just the foundation of that continual struggle and the way, you know, things remain interconnected, obvious as that may sound, whether we like it or not. How you've written before, I know, on a lot of different subjects about the way we need to talk about things and, you know, how you go about talking about, you know, difficult subjects. With something like this, do you have thoughts on just the ways that we should be talking about it in the first place?
Yeah, I do. Of course, we have to recognize that there are certain ironies involved in all of this. We have people like Washington and Jefferson, who are slaveholders, you know, Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry, but they're saying they want to be free from England, but yet they hold slaves. And they don't see the irony and hypocrisy in that position. But it took other people trying to achieve their freedom and their ability to be seen as totally human. When you see that struggle in other people, it forces the people who are denying those rights to have to grant those rights. And I think that's what we've been through here in our country, the struggle of blacks, women, and other people of color to achieve first-class citizenship, point out the irregularities in what we were talking about.
It was really interesting to me in learning about this, because this is a part of our history that, to be perfectly honest, I really didn't know anything about. The resistance that had been there among the American and the British armies towards using black soldiers, because as things went along, both sides were actually using that. And it was very much viewed as this last straw option, despite, you know, many either freed former slaves or current slaves having been demonstrating their worthiness in the fight. And it was really only when the labor itself becomes necessary that either side starts accepting this as a viable option. And it really struck me as indicative of the lack of humanity being afforded to the black Americans, black slaves, and just a reminder of them not really being regarded in this situation so much as just commodities.
Well, you know, people are very willing to ignore certain things if they're going to be rich. So all of the things that I just mentioned about, you know, the hypocrisy and irony about the slaveholders wanting to be free, that was all tied into the fact that if you own slaves here in America, you were going to be wealthy. If you had a cotton plantation, you were going to be wealthy. No question about it. So they were willing to ignore a lot of things in order to make that that possibility happen. And I think that's, you know, where we get caught up.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, that there were often cases where you had owners using slaves, you know, in their place when it came to the actual fight, which was something I had no idea about. The idea that these slaves ultimately were allowed to, if they survived, gain their freedom through battling on either side. It was something being offered by both the American and the British side. Did you get a sense from your research in terms of which side they tended to gravitate towards more?
The slaves went to both sides because they were desperate to change their circumstances. The British were a lot more inclined to keep their word. The revolutionary side did not, by and large, keep their word. But the British kept their word. And, you know, it was in that way that the British dealt with the manpower shortages that affected both sides in the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that. From the research that you did, it turns out that a lot of the colonists did not keep their word in terms of offering that freedom.
Right. James Armistead Lafayette, who gave Washington and the Comte de Lafayette the information that they used to trap Cornwallis in Virginia on the Yorktown Peninsula. Okay, that spy was denied his freedom when the war was over. But the Comte de Lafayette sent a letter to the Virginia legislature petitioning for James Armstead's freedom, and they granted it. They felt that he deserved it because of the help he had given their side. And at that point, James Armstead adapted the last name Lafayette to recognize his benefactor back in France.
Was he one of the lucky ones in terms of actually, you know, having petitions on his behalf and eventually being granted it? Like in terms of other people?
Absolutely.
Absolutely,
because the dollar won out over everything. Yeah, maybe they made them a promise, but hey, forget that promise. We're going to work this person to death because I want to make money. And
right.
that was the attitude that people had.
One of the people that you highlight, there are several different people that were part of this period, but that I found really fascinating was Phyllis Wheatley, a poet. She was published, which at the time was basically unheard of. And she wrote to George Washington, encouraging him to use black soldiers. And it sounds like she was actually pretty influential towards him. And Washington was pretty taken by her words and her ability to express herself. And beyond it being just, you know, striking for that period, what really stood out to me is it being an example and an acknowledgement of intellect among people who had been slaves, or in the case of Phyllis Wheatley, recently freed, that, you know, the intellect that had largely been denied among the African descendants actually really was there if you bothered to look for it and nurture it.
Exactly. You know, Phyllis Wheatley had been taught Greek and Latin, and she was an accomplished poet. So Washington was really impressed with who she was as a human being, and I'm sure that must have informed his thoughts about things. Because, you know, on his deathbed, he freed his slaves. They would be freed upon the death of Martha, and there was one slave that had been with him throughout the war. His last name was Lee. He freed him while Washington was still alive. But I think Washington's willingness to free his slaves upon his death really was something that probably that idea got into his mind from what he saw happening around him, you know, amongst the slave population.
I was going to ask, did you get a sense from your research that, I mean, this is all extremely relative because obviously slavery continued long after the Revolutionary War, but that these contributions from black soldiers, black people at the time, was making any type of even relative progress in terms of, you know, the thought process of wealthier white people in America, or just that they were able to see even somewhat more incremental worthiness and that their mindsets were changing at all?
I think it was a huge amount of diversity in the way people thought about slavery here in the United States. The state of Vermont outlawed slavery in 1777. That's just a couple of months after the Declaration of Independence. They outlawed slavery. In Pennsylvania, which was run by Quakers, they outlawed slavery. And then in other places, you know, slaves were crucial to the economy and to people making money. And there was no way they were going to outlaw it or in any way inhibit the practice. So, you know, it wasn't one idea and one thought process on it. There were several. And it was something that had to be worked out. And it didn't get worked out until the Civil War.
Right. And it's still being worked on in a lot of ways as we speak.
Yeah, we're still trying to get that settled, you know.
I've seen in a few interviews where also you've talked about how in part you wanted to do this documentary to reinforce to people of color how they've always mattered in the history of this country and that this is their country too. Do you get a sense that young people of color understand this, or it's being reinforced to them better than, say, it had been to you when you were a young man?
Most young people of color don't understand it, and they don't. When the history books they get, especially the very first ones, the grade school ones, they don't reflect Black people having anything to do with the fact that we have a nation. This is unfortunate, and it's harmful. It's harmful to white people who want to look down on people who actually they shouldn't look down upon. And it's harmful to Black people who feel that, you know, they have no stake in all of this. You know, we've got to change that.
Right. You've obviously, it's well documented how your love of jazz, and you've written books about it, worked on documentaries about it. How much have you viewed learning about jazz as an extension of learning about or teaching Black history? Like, do you see it through that lens?
Well, you know, I think the Harlem Renaissance produced what we now call jazz, and, you know, a very important part of America's cultural contribution to the world. But that's something we have to learn about. You know, most Americans don't see it that way unless they look at it and study it for a while, and then maybe they can see that. You know, when you look back, Louis Armstrong sent jazz, you know, Louis Armstrong and people like him from his generation sent jazz around the world. You know, the
yes.
20s and 30s were called the jazz age.
And also, too, there was that acceptance around the world. I think not just of the music itself, but of the artists creating it, you know, like an appreciation.
Exactly.
Yeah. That wasn't there in America, even if this is being born in America.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask you, too, with a question regarding Kobe, and in particular about the second act that he was creating for himself after basketball, which reminded me a lot of what you've been doing in terms of either artistic pursuits, literary pursuits, you know, things that really, in a lot of ways, had nothing to do with basketball or nothing directly to do with basketball, you know, that you see in a lot of ex-athletes. Just your impressions of Kobe, that second act, and the things that you were looking forward to seeing from him.
Well, I thought Kobe had a whole lot to offer the world in terms of, you know, his own talent. You saw where he won the Academy Award for that poem that he wrote. And, you know, I think as a parent and as someone who had business ideas and creative ideas, we were just beginning to see something from him. And, you know, we're going to miss out on all that. That's very unfortunate.
But you knew Kobe for obviously a long time. Did you see those sides of him forming, you know, over the course of his playing career, just like the type of curiosity to explore things that really had nothing to do with sports?
No, I didn't get a chance to see that because, you know, I didn't see him on a daily basis. You know, I only got to see the finished products when they came out. But, you know, he hadn't been retired that long, and, you know, here they go. So
yeah,
that didn't surprise me at all, though. You know, that aspect of it didn't surprise me.
And then the last question I'd have for you is just how much of Black history do you think remains either largely untold or entirely untold? And just how much do you think there still really is to learn? And are there particular areas that you'd like to focus on yourself or see more brought to light by other historians?
Well, I just think that what we call Black history is just American history that has been marginalized.
Yes.
And, you know, when that attitude changes, then we will keep it in perspective and deal with a lot of the unfortunate efforts that were made to marginalize and eliminate people of color from our history books.
As frustrating as it is to know that history isn't being told, is there still at least some level of excitement for you when you actually learn it for the first time and that discovery process?
Well, you know, I'm excited that I get a chance to share this with the American public, and the people at History have given me that opportunity. So I'm very thankful for that. You know, that to me is progress. I'm not going to complain about what hasn't been told up to this point. A door has opened and they've allowed me to walk through it, and I'm very thankful. You know, they gave us the opportunity to do it right. You'll see that when you watch it. And, you know, we're just going to move forward from here.
Again, the documentary is called Black Patriots, Heroes of the Revolution. It airs tonight, February 19th, 10 o'clock Eastern and Pacific, 9 o'clock Central on History. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, this was a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Hey, nice talking to you. You have a great day.